Welcome to the Triple D Podcast, Donuts, Disability, and Discourse, where host Michael Leiner talks to the best in the business about community, impact, business, and donuts. Here's your host, Michael Leiner.
Welcome to another episode of the Triple D Podcast. I am so excited by our guest today, Sarah Gelsomino. And let me tell you why, because you're somebody who I run into all the time, like at different lawyerly type functions, and I always enjoy seeing you. You're so bright and colorful and fun. I love going to the party that you have every year, the summer solstice, but it's always like in a group setting. I've never really had a chance to talk to you, even though you're always so fun in the group setting. You are the type of, another reason I'm so excited you're here is you have the type of law practice that I think so many people go to law school wanting to have. But I remember when we go to law school, there's like the people that are like, I'm going to be a corporate attorney. And then there's the second track of people who say, you know, I want to fight for justice and I'm going to, you know, I want to, you know, wrongful imprisonment. And then I'm going to sue the city that imprisoned them. And that's kind of the career path. I might be putting it in too much of a nutshell, how would you describe your law practice to someone?
I'm a civil rights lawyer.
Okay.
So our practice is specifically prison and police misconduct. We do a lot of wrongful conviction work, and we have a criminal defense practice. My dream practice has always been a civil rights practice, you know, doing the civil side of police and prison misconduct, a post-conviction practice, so we're actually like working to get people out of prison, and then also a criminal defense practice, because those three worlds really intertwine so much. That's what we're building. That's kind of what we're doing.
It's fascinating that because individually those three practice areas are so distinct, but you have one case that just flows and it touches all of them. So why should somebody need to have two or three different lawyers to help them through something? You said a word that excites me. You said that's what we're building.
Oh yeah.
Tell me about that. Tell me about the build. Tell us a little bit about your firm and how what it was like before you started like building it.
First of all, my firm in Chicago was, I feel really lucky to have, right out of law school, I got my dream job, like really my dream job.
That's crazy.
At the People's Law Office in Chicago, where I got to train under like the civil rights giants in this country. I mean, people who just really shaped this area of law. Mm-hmm. And we're more than just lawyers. We're people's lawyers. So working with communities, taking our direction from communities, doing a lot of political work in addition to just straight legal work, and that is really important to me. So when we moved here, I was looking for that kind of a practice. And there were some people doing civil rights work in Ohio, but no real firm, you know? So I came here and I joined Terry Gilbert in practice, who had been doing civil rights work and criminal defense work here in Cleveland for over 40 years.
Right.
And he's wonderful and continues to do that work now, you know, even though he's been practicing for well over 40 years. And he had the vision to the kind of like, you know, I think it was hard for him to let me in, but he saw that he really believed that it was important to have good, solid political civil rights lawyers to maintain the work that had been so important to him, right? And that he had been building. He didn't want that just to die. And I give him a lot of credit for that. So I came and joined him and Jacqueline Green in practice. But I always wanted that trifold, right? So that's kind of been what I've been pushing for and what we're doing. And so we brought in Marcus Sidoti to run our criminal defense practice. He had a practice for over 20 years with Jordan Sidoti. I shouldn't say over 20 years. A long time, nearly 20 years. So that we could have that really, really strong trial practice and criminal defense practice. So that felt like a really natural fit for us to bring him in. And then we were able to merge with Al Gerhardstein's firm. Al and Terry were contemporaries. Al is based in Cincinnati. It has the dreamiest retirement ever. His priorities are to be with his kids and his grandkids who are out of state. So we were able to take over that firm so that he can spend most of his time with his kids and grandkids.
Yeah.
But he still has, you know, he still works on cases, and he's a great mentor to us in the firm. So we have kind of this younger and older generations now working together with our office in Cincinnati. And here we do work cases all over.
Right.
But bringing these like powerhouse practices together has been really exciting, right? Because we have so much great history and institutional knowledge in this area of law to build on. But we have now Jacqueline Marcus and I run the practice, and you know, we're really aligned in wanting to continue to do really mission-driven, effective, holistic lawyering for our clients who we're very close to, especially our clients who are exonerees. So that's kind of, you know, and so we're constantly building. I feel like we're never stopping to, you know, this idea of like, what can we do more? How can we do more?
So with this, like, setup of you have these older, you call them contemporary attorneys who have these big reputations and been working at this for a long time, and then there's like a you know, a generation that comes in below that. Was there resistance to, here's how we see this going? We see there being a strong criminal practice, a strong civil practice, or was it, you know, open arms to begin with? Yeah, let's do this. Bring this in here.
I think in terms of the vision, there's really been open arms. I mean, Terry always did criminal and civil, right?
Okay.
I think that to have large practice areas, both of those on a firm level, is a little more complicated. You know, Terry and Gordon Friedman had been really, I mean, had achieved so much with really just the two of them and some, you know, an army of law clerks, you know, kind of filtering in and out. But the practice of law is different now, I think. And the area that we practice in police and prison misconduct, is getting harder and harder. And frankly, so is criminal defense. It's just getting harder and harder for our people. Immunities for police are higher. Every time we turn around, it seems that civil rights are being taken, are being like chipped away at by the courts. So you just have to be so precise and so careful now in bringing these cases. It's really... I mean, it's a tough area of law, honestly.
Give us, I mean, you've had so many cases that are in the news. I mean, you're probably in the newspaper as much as any lawyer that I know in Cleveland, or just media generally. But give us like an example of a case that kind of follows this whole trajectory where they're using all parts of your firm to like get the help that they need. Is there like an example of something that's out there that comes to mind? Something that really you felt passionate about?
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of clients who come to us. We have a case right now that we were brought in to try the criminal case. He was charged with, I think it was felonious assault.
Mm-hmm.
Often when people are subjected to excessive use of force by police, they face cover charges, we call them, some kind of criminal charge in order to try to hide that police misconduct, right? So one current case we have right now for a young man who was shot by the police, we were brought in to try the criminal case. We tried the criminal case. Now we're trying the civil case. So Marcus tried that criminal case, and then we immediately filed the civil rights case, and we're handling that now. We did that also with Isaiah Andrews, who was in the news quite a lot. Isaiah did 46 years in prison for the murder of his wife. He was innocent.
Yeah.
Came out in his 80s, sick, truly dying of cancer. And the Ohio Innocence Project did that work to get him out of prison. Once he was out of prison, we were brought in to retry the criminal case because the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office insisted on retrying this man with no evidence. It was honestly an incredible waste of resources. And it was cruel. It was cruel to Isaiah. But he had to sit through another criminal trial in his wheelchair. Marcus tried that criminal case, won it, and then we were able to file a wrongful imprisonment case for Isaiah in the state court, and also a federal 1983 case, a civil rights case for him in federal court.
So you talked about how like Marcus is running the criminal division in your office. You're more focused on like the civil litigation piece. For example, when you have the criminal trial happening, the criminal piece to it, are you involved with that to help with the civil piece afterwards, potentially if there is one?
Yeah.
Or how does the crossover happen?
Yeah, when we see a case that has potential civil rights implications, and sometimes criminal defense lawyers call us. All criminal defense lawyers should call us. This is important. when you're doing
cut to the commercial.
Case, I mean, not just to bring us the work, but because you have to protect these claims for your clients.
Yeah.
If you don't understand the implications
in
the criminal case for the potential civil case in the future, you can really hurt your client.
So even in the type of work that I do, there's such a clear analogy where, you know, people just think I'm going to hire a disability lawyer and they can handle anything across the spectrum of like social security, disability litigation. But there's a ton of law firms, and we just brought in an attorney, Deb Schifrin, who had a, you know, great reputation, but she runs our federal court practice, which is so different than our administrative law practice. And most people don't know what's happening in that other world. You'll have an attorney who lives in one, you know, lives it doing one piece of the puzzle, and then attorneys that are focused on the other part. But really, if you want to know how to win an administrative law case, you better understand what wins in federal court and vice versa.
Right.
And I think that that's something that so many practices are missing. So that's why I'm so interested in like where the crossover is in the life of your cases. Now, when you think about, you know, are most of your cases locally? Are they regionally? What's it like for you with the type of practice that you guys have?
Most of our cases are in Ohio.
Yeah.
But not, they're all over Ohio, all over. I just yesterday was getting admitted to the, or figuring out how to e-file in Ross County, because we have a case being filed against Ross County.
Is that Ohio?
It is Ohio.
Okay.
And you have to file 24 hours in advance if you want them to accept an electronic filing.
You have to file to file?
You have to, it takes them 24 hours to accept an electronic filing, which is really wild. So, most of our cases
are
in Ohio.
They just got computers in Ross County.
I guess so. They haven't.
Yeah.
Electronic filing is very intimidating to some counties. Most of our practice is in federal. Most of our civil rights practice is in federal court.
Okay.
But we do have a lot of cases in state court. A lot of cases from northern Kentucky, because we have a Cincinnati office.
Yeah.
There's a lot of turnover there. But I'm currently litigating a case in New York. I tried a case in Virginia. We have a wrongful conviction case out of Hawaii pending in California court. We practice all over.
How important is using the media to your practice?
I in my practice have always used the media. I think for a number of reasons. One is the government is not afraid to use the media to state a narrative. They shift the narrative all the time, and that is the, or they claim the narrative, I should say, right? And that's a norm. People think that's normal, you know? I mean, when there's a big drug raid and the AUSA is out there with, like, piles of drugs on the table, they're shaping a narrative. And I think it's important for us to shape the narrative, right? It's important for us to tell our truth. But it's especially important, I think, for my clients to have access to the media, because they have been lied on, they have been violated, their trust in the entire system has been destroyed because of what they've gone through. And it's important for people to understand that that's the reality of our criminal legal system. I love when our exoneree clients in particular get to tell their stories publicly, because there's healing that comes from that, there's power that comes from that for them. You know, when their entire lives have been destroyed because someone lied on them. Someone in a position of power, someone who is an agent of the state. And then, you know, when they get to turn around and say their truth publicly, that's an incredible thing to experience.
Do you ever get resistance from the media when you approach them about telling these stories? Or is it something that naturally they want to hear more about and discuss in the narrative?
The media is very interested in it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my cases tend to be a little more salacious than some other practices in law.
All right.
You know, there's,
I'm in the wrong practice area.
Interested in, and especially now when police misconduct and government misconduct is more, people know that it happens.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time there weren't cameras, and so people, I don't think there's more police misconduct now. I don't think there's more police violence. I just think that we now know that it's happening. It's harder to hide now. And because we've seen some really horrific things happen on video, we now, a good part of the population at least, now understands what is possible. You know, it used to be like, police would never do that. And now we see it happening, and you think, oh, maybe they would, maybe some would, maybe he would, you know, maybe this is true. So, you know, generally I think the media likes to talk about it. And I think this is my area of law, well, so is yours, but this is a matter of public concern.
Absolutely.
You know, people in the community need to understand this. These lawsuits are being paid by taxpayer money. These prosecutorial decisions to waste money prosecuting people who shouldn't be prosecuted, it's a waste of taxpayer money. It has a direct impact on people. And it has a direct impact on community safety. You know, when there's a denigration of trust with the people who are supposed to keep you safe, that is a deep, deep problem that goes into the core of society. So we need to be talking about it publicly.
And I'm so interested in this because, you know, we spend a lot of time trying, it's one of the reasons we have a podcast and all these other media channels, is it's really important to us to spread the word and tell that story. But for some reason, there's more resistance. Maybe it's that I don't have the salaciousness of your cases, but I think they're interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's this government system that is set up intentionally in a way to make people fail.
Right.
And we're like the warriors trying to put them, the clients on our backs and carry them through this process. But, like, we want to tell that story because it's Clevelanders, it's Ohioans. I mean, we have a federal practice, so it's people all across the country, and, you know, we represent people all over that are being harmed. But it's, like, hard to get that story told, and it's so frustrating for us. But I agree with you. When we do bring our clients into that media narrative, it does make them feel a little bit relieved. And when you first interact with your clients, so you might come to them and you're working on the criminal piece first. Is there like a resistance that they have to working with a lawyer? I mean, are they skeptical or are they like just somebody's willing to help me?
Oh, everyone's different.
Yeah.
But I don't think at the beginning people are as skeptical. Our cases take a long time. I don't know how long yours take.
How long does one of your cases take?
I mean, I tell people on to be ready for 5 to 10 years.
It's not, I mean, a disability case, an average disability case takes 2 to 3 years, but if we have to go to federal court, I mean, I have cases that take a decade.
Yeah, easy. Right, so do we. So at the beginning, I'm all, you know, this is why I always tell people, if there's a, you know, you got to feel good about your decision for a lawyer. You just have to have like a gut trust feeling. If you don't feel that, then you need to find another lawyer because it's a long journey.
It's a marriage.
Right? And it's intense, and you are going to have some hard times together in the course of that litigation and really honest conversations, and I'm going to end up telling you things you don't want to hear.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I don't want to have to say, right, but that's just kind of the barriers that we face are so great along the way, right? And so I feel like, you know, there are moments in litigation where our clients struggle with the system and struggle with us. At the beginning, generally not, you know, like, but we build that kind of trust and relationship along the way so that we can get through the tough times together.
What's that initial client conversation like? And I'm not talking about the specifics of it have to be tied to like the facts of the case to a degree, I imagine, but like, there still has to be a narrative that follows what we're talking about where you're like setting clients' expectations and we're going to be together for a long run here, so I want to make sure you feel comfortable. What do you say to your clients?
You know, our clients come to us because something horrible has happened.
Yeah.
Right? We don't ever, nobody wants to make the phone call to people like us, right? I represent a lot of people whose loved ones have been murdered by police. So there's just a lot of emotion at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
I think it's really important for people to define victory for themselves. You know, I don't believe that the criminal legal system is a place of justice. I don't believe that any of my clients will ever feel justice or vindication.
Yeah.
There is some sense of relief when a judge or a jury finds for a client and they feel for the first time that someone listened, that someone acknowledged their pain. But most people come to me and they want an apology. They want an acknowledgement from the city. They want a, you know, a statement from the police officer. Or they want the police officer himself to have to pay for some of the, to feel it, right? To have some kind of personal skin in the game about because of what they did.
Yeah.
Or to get fired. Most people want the cop to be fired, never to be on the street again. And I have to tell them that that hardly ever happens. Or get charged. I want the cop to be fired and criminally charged. And that hardly ever happens. Most of the time, by the time I'm sitting down with clients, those officers are back on the street, even after they've killed someone. They get back on the street very quickly.
Wow.
So I'm, you know, the beginning of our relationship is filled with, like, bad news after bad news after bad news. We can't get them fired. We can't get them, we can't go after, rarely does a police officer have to pay anything out of his own pocket.
Right.
You know, I mean, the city indemnifies and pay, the city will pay any kind of judgment. And he's just right back doing it. And they will never get an apology or a true acknowledgement from the city for anything.
And what do the clients say when you tell them that? I mean, it's, I'm sure the response is...
I mean, they're angry. They're angry. And that's what I'm saying about, you know, when you just, you know, if there's a car accident and someone, you know, rear-ends you or something, right? You know, there's... That sucks. And, you know, and there's... But it's not like the very foundation of your, of the society that you live in has crumbles around you. And that's what happens when people are harmed by the police.
Yeah.
You know, when they realize the power of the government to take away liberty and life without any kind of consequence, it's really hard to walk around in the street and to live your life and to be a productive member of society with that kind of fear and distrust. I mean, that is the true impact of police violence that people, I think, you know, average people don't understand.
Has the work that you've done over the years significantly shaped your view of law enforcement?
Sure. It has.
Can you talk about that?
I mean, I grew up like a West Park girl, right? It's where all the cops and firefighters live.
Right.
I've observed over the years that I think it is very hard for people to stay good and true to their morals in a police department. I think it is really hard. It is not a problem of one bad apple. It is a systemic problem in police departments where culturally it is okay to hurt people and it is okay to skirt the law. I don't think that all police are necessarily bad people, like bad humans. I'm not saying that by any stretch of the means. I don't mean that. But I think that they have a real uphill battle to maintain integrity in a policing system that is inherently racist and violent and occupies certain parts of our cities in ways that cause way, way more harm than good.
With the work that you're doing, do you believe that the problem is getting better, lessened, or is it only something that's escalating and getting worse over time? I mean, your idea has to be when we hold people accountable, that's like step one to some sort of systemic change.
That's what we hope. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we want to work ourselves out of a job, right? We hope that if we can hit the cities in their pocketbooks enough, right, that there will be some change, some call for change, right? Like, why are we paying out? I mean, I litigate a lot against the city of, well, this happens with a lot of cities, but, you know, the city of Cleveland is very upset and very concerned that the lawsuits against them right now could
bankrupt the city.
Yes.
It happened to East Cleveland, didn't it?
Well, East Cleveland is...
I mean, when your assets are a couch, it's not that hard to go bankrupt.
Yeah, it's not quite the same. And I mean, I'm hearing this from other cities right now, too. But they've been saying this, it's a common chorus, right? For as long as I've known anyone to be practicing civil rights law, this is what they've been saying. It's nothing new. But my response to that is, then do it right.
Yeah.
Like, none of this work is necessary if you just do it right. And so what I'm waiting for is a demand from the cities, a demand from the county to their police departments, to their jails, to the prisons, saying, enough, enough. We're not doing this anymore. We'll clean up what happened before, but we demand different policing. And also, like, really looking and hearing from community people at a way to drastically re-envision how we police. A lot of clients that we have are people who, this is so tragic, but people who are experiencing mental health crises. There's no one for those family members to call except the police, right? Who are you going to call if your family member is actively suicidal and needs help? So the police are called, and so often the police end up killing the person who the family called for help, you know, looking for help for that person, and they end up dead at the hands of the police.
Yeah.
Why do we have a system where we rely on the police to come and deal with a mental health crisis? Our crisis intervention training in police departments is not sufficient. And there are other models that are working in places that we can just, like, shift our resources and shift our dynamics. We have to dare to dream a different way to secure community safety. Because what we have now is, as I said, it's causing more harm than good. We can't keep going this way.
So can you just tell us a little bit more about, like, what are the solutions that you think are out there? What can be, instead of calling the police, and I think in a lot of parts of the country now they almost have, like, ride-along type programs where there'll be, like, a mental health clinician who's riding with a police officer on those calls. Is that the solution, or is it, let's get a police officer out of there?
I think you can get a police officer out of there most of the time. Okay. Yeah, I don't think that's necessary. And there are models that there are no police officers responding in those kinds of situations. I mean, what are my solutions to, like, the general problem of police violence?
Well, you can tell us that, but I feel like it's so deeply ingrained in the system now that it's going to be hard to, like, name a bunch of things to be done. There's not necessarily a blueprint for it.
Right.
I think that the best thing that you can do is just keep doing the great work that you do to help people and hope that lessons get learned. But, you know, it is a problem when behaviors don't get corrected, when the person can do whatever they do and go right back on the street, or they'll be forced to take a leave with pay. The judgment, we can say that a city claims they're going to be bankrupt. This is all, is it not largely funded by an insurance company in the back end anyways?
Well, a lot of cities, some cities do have insurance, others are self-insured. Okay. But cities, no one's going bankrupt over any of these lawsuits. I mean, that's just not a reality. That's a red herring for sure. You know, the paid vacation after killing someone really gets me, because that's exactly what it is, you know?
Yeah.
You're off the street for a little while with pay. You're not dinged in your record. You know, everything is approved by the supervisors almost always. There's one case that I have in Columbus. I represent the family of Casey Goodson, who was shot by a police officer, a Franklin County Sheriff's officer.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, interesting, actually, it's one of the rare occasions where the officer is actually being charged with killing Casey, which is incredible. And was, you know, definitely a relief for the family. But it's been a horrific process to even just, like, go through that. You know, Marcy's Law all of a sudden doesn't really apply so greatly as it does in other cases when you're talking about a person who's been killed by the police. But that sheriff's officer is actually recorded before he shot Casey, making this incredible comment about how, you know, if force is used, he said some crazy stuff about using force, but then said they'll take the vacation. Like, that it's just okay, you know, there's just this culture that it's okay that, you know, we'll all just take a couple of days.
And he's commenting on this before the shooting
before he killed Casey.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
He was a dangerous police officer from the start. And that's another thing, you know, police departments should have, they're called early warning systems.
Mm-hmm.
An effective early warning system in place looks for, you know, red flags.
Yeah.
Looking for red flags. And they exist. You know, most police officers don't kill anyone. Some police officers kill multiple people. Some police officers go their whole career without firing their gun.
Yeah.
And others are pulling it out all the time. Like, they're, you know, there are, not everyone should be a police officer. you know? And so early warning systems can be put in place to try to catch that before the really bad thing happens. So there are tools available.
Yeah. It feels like that would have to be one of the most effective ways of at least limiting police violence and police brutality is by having a tougher screening process. I just wonder if there's a lack of people that want to go into
right
that
now
work to begin with. I mean,
right,
realistically, it's not a particularly high-paying job when you think about the risk. That there are real risks involved with being a police officer, and it's not necessarily being shot by somebody. It's getting in a car crash
right.
from a high-speed chase.
Right.
And I remember when I worked at a workers' compensation law firm, we had a ton of police officer clients, and it wasn't from, like, you know, it was a car accident that they were
right.
all in, because it is dangerous work.
Yeah.
Even when it's done right. Even when
yeah,
it's done
for
right.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's just hard to get the right people in there, because how do you get people who are smart, mentally strong, not afraid of the potential risks and dangers
yeah.
of the job? Oh, and by the way, they're willing to work for $70,000 a year. Maybe that might be on the high end of what a police officer even makes. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Different departments. Yeah.
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 And then, you know, once you get the people, and they have to be trained right, and they have to be supervised right, and
yeah.
the culture has to be right. Yeah.
Right. Well,
but you or I mean, we have ethics. We have to report to a board, right?
Yeah.
Who evaluates our ethics. Police don't have anything like that. I mean, I think that would make a huge difference if police had to maintain a license like that.
Yeah.
So you had an ethics board that,
like,
was
ongoing education that was required of them.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
we've
got to
do CLEs.
And stuff. They do have training.
Yeah. Do we live in a safe city relative to, and I'm specifically talking about thinking about the work that you do. I mean, I feel like there's so much publicity about bad actors in the Northeast Ohio police departments. I mean, there was that Serial podcast. There's a Netflix special that involves, you know, by downtown, that terrible, there was all those police officers that were shooting into a car.
Oh,
sorry, I can't
yes,
remember the name.
Yes.
But there's a lot of, like, incidents in Cleveland in particular about, you know, bad actors in mm-hmm. police. Is that everywhere, or do we just live in a place that's
That's interesting.
More dangerous?
I don't think that we live in a place that's particularly dangerous.
Yeah.
But I think that it's Cuyahoga County is the has some of the top numbers in the country for wrongful convictions.
Wow.
And you gotta wonder why that is, right? That is a consequence both of policing and prosecuting.
Yeah.
But when we're being called out in the country for that, I think there needs to be a lot of internal work there to think about how that happened and whether it's still happening.
Yeah. Well, this is the fascinating conversation that I knew that we would have when you agreed to join us. And I'm so grateful that you came and offered some of your time, because I know you have a busy schedule. But now's the part of the podcast that I get excited about every week.
Is it donut time?
It's donut time.
You
ready to try
a
donut?
I am kind of a donut snob.
Uh-oh.
Donuts are, like, my thing.
Really?
Yeah.
How come you never told me that before?
I didn't know that we shared this interest.
All right,
well, let's
try. What is your favorite donut, by the way? I feel like I'm about to let you down.
Well, I mean,
kind of donut. Goldies.
I don't know. I can't say that. I'm not going to be disappointed, I don't think.
Okay.
What is my favorite kind of donut? I like an old-fashioned, or I like glazed.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I don't
luckily,
like a lot of sprinkles or a lot of extras.
I didn't do that for you, Sarah. No. We have the traditional glazed donut here.
Right.
Which is on your list. I'm going to let you reach in there and pull one out. We'll do a little donut cheers, and we'll sample what Goldie's has to offer us.
Ooh, can't wait.
Here we go.
That's really good.
It is really good. In your donut snobbery.
No, I like
so,
it.
Yeah,
I do.
I think so, too. It's got a great glaze on the outside. It's sweet, but not too sweet. I think it's
offset. That's what I like about it.
Yeah. Sometimes I have a glazed donut, and it's like, I need some water.
Mm-hmm.
Blows me back, but this is actually.
I love how it melts.
Me, too. Melts in my mouth, not in my hand.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm just grateful for your friendship, and also for your time and joining us
yeah,
and sharing
same.
Your
chat.
Awesome career stories with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Triple D Podcast, Donuts, Disability, and Discourse. Rate, subscribe, and tune in next week for more discourse and donuts.